Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Jill Robbins, Anna Mateo, and Alice Bryant. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
For most people around the world, applying for admission to a college or university is a major event in their lives. Many young people see it as one of their first steps toward becoming adults. It is also a lot of work. The competition and risk of rejection can create a lot of stress, and not just for the applicants. Parents of high school students are often very involved in the college search process. Sometimes they are even more invested in the application results than the students themselves.
Fiona Reese is a senior associate director of international admissions at the University of California in Los Angeles. She says most students in the United States would list their parents as the main influence on their college application decisions. Even when the students are appearing like they don't want to listen to their parents, they clearly are, Reese told VOA. And so, it's important for the parents to be supportive of the students. Students look to their parents for all kinds of advice, she says, including where to go and what to study. But Reese argues there is also some important advice parents need to hear if they want to be as helpful as possible to their children. First, parents must accept that there are limits to what they know about the application process, she says.
She says even parents who attended university in the U.S. themselves must understand that a lot has changed in just the last 20 years. It is important for parents to join their children in researching the most current college and university requirements. Working together is important for success, Reese says, and it can be an important time for parents and students to strengthen their relationships with each other. Reese says parents need to fully devote themselves to the process if they get involved. She describes one college admissions informational meeting in which she witnessed a parent repeatedly leave the room for phone calls. Reese says the parent may have missed important information. But as important is the impression such behavior creates. The parent seemed to not care about the student's interest in attending the school. It's really important that the parents take the time to tell their child how proud they are of them and to tell them that you love them no matter what, Reese said. Because the students need to hear that. We forget that while they're young adults, they're still only usually 17, 18 years old, and they need to hear that from their parents.
Reese says parents also need to be honest. They may want to protect their children and provide them with everything they want. But students need to know if there are limits to their college search. For example, will finances restrict their choices? Reese says parents must tell their children exactly how much money they will provide for college. What about distance? Reese says she once got a phone call from unhappy parents demanding to know why the school had accepted their child whose home was far away. They wanted their child to study closer to home. But they had never discussed that with the student, thinking the application would not be successful. Reese says it is important for parents to express such concerns before the student applies to any school. It is a thin line to walk, Reese suggests. Parents should talk to their future college students, of course. But she says parents also must listen to them. In the end, Reese notes, it is the child who will be attending the college, not the parents. Young people may not be clear on what their educational interests or desires are. Parents may not care for some of their child's choices. But, Reese says, making such decisions is an important part of becoming an adult.
Such independence is important when it comes to completing college applications as well. Parents may feel the urge to help their children write an essay or fill out a form. Reese advises parents to fight that urge. Young people must learn to meet deadlines and take responsibility, she says. Valuable lessons can be learned in the application process. And schools demand the applicant be the author of his or her application. Finally, Reese says, most students will likely be rejected by at least one college or university. Parents, she says, can greatly help their children move beyond such rejection in a healthy way. It's much like when you have a toddler and they fall down, she said. If you rush to them and say, oh, you must be hurt. Are you okay? The child is going to react accordingly. If you say, you're fine, get up, off we go, then your child is also going to react accordingly. They will get some letters of denial. They are not personal rejections, and it is important that you help to remind your child that they are still a good person. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we are going on a make-believe trip to the countryside to learn about a word that comes from something used on a farm, haywire. Like it sounds, haywire is a strong, thin wire. Farm workers often use it to tie up hay grown in the fields. They roll up the long cut grass and store it in large bundles. Later, when farm animals need to be fed, the wire is cut. You need to use a hatchet or something else with a very sharp edge to cut the wire. Haywire does not break easily, but it can get easily twisted together by accident. So that is the farm material called haywire. But what does it mean to go haywire? The expression to go haywire has several meanings. To go haywire can mean to turn crazy, unreasonable, or wild. As in this example, if I don't take a break from work soon, I am going to go haywire. Here, the expressions flip out or freak out have a similar meaning. These are all informal or for everyday use. If you want to be more formal, you could use the word berserk. To go haywire also means to start malfunctioning or failing to operate normally. We often use this expression for machines that don't work as they should. For example, let's say we are visiting a peanut butter factory. A machine used to pump peanut butter into jars suddenly goes haywire. It squirts peanut butter everywhere, on the floor, on walls, and on factory workers. Soon, the whole area is covered with the tasty but sticky food. So the machine is not only broken, it made a huge mess. Haywire can also mean to become out of control. When a process fails to work as planned, you can also say it ran amok. This expression is more formal. Here is an example of this meaning of haywire.
Plans for my outdoor party just went haywire. The supermarket can't bring the birthday cake. The musicians refuse to play. There's no place to leave a car because of unannounced street repairs in front of my house. Oh, great. And it's going to rain. It's going to rain hard.
But how did this simple farm word come to mean go wild? Language experts say there are two stories that help explain where this meaning came from. As we said earlier, Americans use haywire to describe a state of disorder, extreme messiness. In other words, a situation where everything seems to be going wrong. Years ago, farmers used haywire to temporarily fix a damaged fence, gate, or barrier. But the wire was never a good choice for permanent repairs because it breaks down easily. The metal iron turns reddish-brown and wears down when attacked by oxygen in the air or water. In other words, it rusts. This fact, however, did not stop people from using it for repairs. As a result, many fences and buildings where lots of wire were used for repairs look messy. They have gone haywire. Another story about haywire comes from the material itself. When you cut tightly wound wire, you should do so carefully. It can suddenly spring back at you, like a snake. It can circle your body and then stab you with its sharp ends. This can happen quickly, often catching a person off guard. Word experts may not agree on the origin, but they can agree that anything that has gone haywire has gone crazy or is a big hot mess. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
One late night in May, Philip Meade was looking for historical objects from the American Revolution. He noticed a painting being offered for sale on the internet. Suddenly, he felt his heartbeat speeding up. Meade is the chief historian at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The painting is an unsigned watercolor from 1782. It shows the army tent that George Washington had used as his command center during the Revolutionary War. And to Meade, this seemed to be the only known artwork from that period to show this tent. The painting is the top exhibit at the museum, which opened in April 2017. And, thanks to Meade, the museum now owns the painting, which will be the centerpiece of a show next year. Meade said the discovery seemed almost too good to be true. "I've had this level of excitement only a handful of times in my 30 years of looking for this stuff," he said. When Meade saw the tent painting, he immediately emailed the image to Scott Stevenson. Stevenson serves as the museum's Vice President of Collections exhibitions, and programming. He said his heart jumped when he realized what the painting was. The next step was to quickly find people willing to donate money to buy the painting, which was up for auction. It was to be sold just days after Mead's discovery. He and Stevenson were concerned that they might not be the only people to have seen the rare work. And they were not sure the painting was exactly what they'd hoped. But they still followed their plan. The painting got only one other bidder, and so the Museum of the American Revolution easily bought the painting for $12,000. Then, museum workers studied the picture and confirmed that it shows the Continental Army's fall encampment at Verplanck's Point, New York. The painter was a French-born engineer, Pierre L'Enfant. He served in the Continental Army. L'Enfant was wounded at the Siege of Savannah and taken prisoner at the surrender of Charleston, South Carolina. When released, he went back to serve with Washington for the rest of the war. Years later, he worked on planning the design for Washington, D.C. The painting shows hundreds of military tents across the hills of New York's Hudson Valley. On the left side is Washington's Field Command Center, including the tent. Most artwork about the war was created after it, historians say. So the images didn't necessarily show real events. Mead said having a painting by L'Enfant is like having a Google Street View look at the Revolutionary War encampment. Although L'Enfant did not sign the painting, it is similar to the one he made in 1782 of troops at West Point, New York. The family who cared for L'Enfant at the end of his life gave it to the United States Library of Congress. The appearance, the dates of both paintings, and the handwriting helped to confirm L'Enfant as the painter. Sometime in the past, the original tent painting was cut into 6 pieces of paper and placed into a folder. An expert is working to clean the painting and put the pieces back together so it can be shown as it was meant to. It will be the central piece of an exhibit called Among His Troops, Washington's War Tent in a Newly Discovered Watercolor. The exhibition will open on January 13, 2018. To offer visitors a more complete show, the museum is also borrowing the West Point painting from the Library of Congress. I'm Alice Bryant.
This week, we visit a national park that marks one of the most important events in American history. We are exploring the Gettysburg National Military Park in the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Much of the area around Gettysburg still looks like it did in the 1860s during the Civil War. The town is in the middle of farm country. All around are fields of wheat, corn, and other crops. Cows chew on grass under a warm morning sun. Roads that pass through Gettysburg lead to Baltimore, Washington, and other big cities. But years ago, they served another purpose. The roads brought two opposing armies to Gettysburg. One was the United States Army of the Potomac, commanded by General George Gordon Meade. The other was the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, led by General Robert E. Lee. His troops had moved north into Pennsylvania from Virginia. There, they had won a series of battles. Now, they were on the move to defeat Meade's army. Lee believed that a southern victory on northern land would force a negotiated settlement of the war. This would mean independence for the Confederate states that were attempting to leave the Union.
The Battle of Gettysburg began on July 1, 1863. More than 170,000 soldiers fought for 3 days. It was the largest battle ever fought in North America. When it ended on July 3rd, more than 50,000 soldiers were dead, wounded, or missing. Many more would die later from their wounds. In the end, General Lee's army lost the battle. The Civil War, though, continued for 2 more years. But Confederate hopes for independence were never again as high as they had been at Gettysburg. Soon after the Great Battle, people began to visit Gettysburg to try to understand what happened there. One of those visitors, on November 19, 1863, was President Abraham Lincoln. He was invited to help dedicate a ceremony for Union soldiers killed in the battle. Lincoln spoke for just 2 minutes. His speech began this way.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
President Lincoln had never been satisfied with the reality of American life at that time. The Declaration of Independence in 1776 had declared all men equal. Yet in the South, and earlier in the North as well, black men and women were held as slaves. In his address at Gettysburg, Lincoln described a new future for a nation that would be reunited.
It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work for which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom.
Gettysburg National Military Park was established in 1895, 32 years after the deadly battle. Gettysburg is the most visited of the Civil War battlefields. Every year, about 2 million people visit the park from around the country and the world. The battlefield covers more than 2,400 hectares. Visitors can find more than 1,300 outdoor sculptures around the battlefield. These are monuments and memorials placed by soldiers' groups and state militias in areas where their troops fought. Volunteer guides explained to visitors what happened in each area of the huge battlefield. Visitors can also tour the battlefields on their own, by foot, by car, or by bicycle. Many visitors start their visit to Gettysburg at the Gettysburg Museum of the Civil War. The museum has the world's largest collection of Civil War objects. The museum has more than 1 million items, from soldiers' private notebooks and uniforms to original maps of the battlefield.
The museum also houses the Gettysburg Cyclorama painting. This kind of artwork surrounds the people looking at it. The painting shows the final attack in the Battle of Gettysburg, Pickett's charge. George Pickett was a Confederate general. On July 3, 1863, he led a charge against stronger Union forces. It was a disaster for the Confederate soldiers. French artist Paul Philippoteau and a team of 20 artists created the painting in the 1880s. Philippoteau and his team visited the battlefield. It took more than 1 year for the huge painting to be completed. The cyclorama is 114 meters long and almost 13 meters tall. It has long been one of the most popular parts of the Gettysburg experience. But by the 1990s, the painting was in poor condition. Experts warned that if the cyclorama was not repaired, the painting could be lost. A restoration project began in 2003. The painting was cleaned and separated into its 14 parts, and later moved into the new center. There, the original canvas was sewn onto new cloth made in China. Park Service officials say China was one of the few countries able to produce cloth in the sizes needed. Then each part was hung and sewn together. A team of cyclorama experts from Poland worked on the project in Gettysburg. The repair work of the Gettysburg cyclorama marked one of the largest art conservation efforts ever in North America.
After the museum, tourists can visit the Soldiers' National Cemetery, where many of the Union soldiers who died during the Battle of Gettysburg are buried. The cemetery was dedicated on November 19, 1863, the same day President Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address. Since 1865, the cemetery has been a burial ground for soldiers from all of America's wars. Gettysburg brings history to life during the summer and fall with its living historians. These actors and experts show visitors what life was like for a soldier here, in one of the most historically important places in America. The words of America's 16th president from the Gettysburg battlefield have never been forgotten. Historians agree that Lincoln's Gettysburg Address defined Americans as a people who believed in freedom, democracy, and equality. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.